Now, today, just before I came in here, our secretary told me that I got two emails asking for subjects for this evening's talk. And those two emails, one said talk about experience, and I thought he probably must have meant there was actually a rock band called Experience with Jimi Hendrix when I was young. Perhaps he wanted me to talk about that this evening. So not quite sure exactly what they meant by experience, but part of the talk's going to be on experience, and the other part of the talk, they gave me a quote about, or a saying, how can you have your cake and eat it? So that's going to be testing me out today, about how to combine those two subjects into one talk about Buddhism, about Dhamma. The first part is very much easier, because experience is something which is much more powerful and has always been central to the Buddha's teachings, as I've taught many, many times, that in Buddhism we really start to put aside all the theories. Even the stuff which you read about in the books, the suttas, even that is only looked upon as being a guideline to what's really true. We look upon those things as signposts which point to some meaning inside of ourselves. They're very useful, but we can't actually just stop at teachings. Even what you hear from a monk should not always be taken to be absolute truth. Do you understand that? Even what a monk said, you should not believe. So people say, Ajahn Brahm told us that we should not believe the monks. And you believe me again. But the point is that we're pointing to something, which is that sometimes that you believe people just too easily. Even though that the person speaking might be absolutely correct, we sometimes might misunderstand them, get the wrong idea. Sometimes what they say is not really what you hear. Very often, and this happens in ordinary life as well as listening to a talk like this, actually something changes from what comes out of my mouth until by the time it gets into your ears, it's all changed around. It's not the same thing. I've done that many times when I've said something and people have actually completely misunderstood what I meant. For example, there's an old story from Nasruddin in the Sufi tradition. Nasruddin had a friend who had a young man, and they used to be in the salt trade. They used to take salt from one place to another on donkey backs. Whenever they were crossing one of these rivers, they had these very narrow bridges, rope bridges. And they're only that narrow that only one donkey could go across them at a time. And this fellow Nasruddin saw this man, or rather the man's son, taking one of the donkeys across, and the donkey was leading to the left. And so the man shouted out to his son, because if it led any more to the left, it would fall in. He said, push it to the left, push it to the left. Whenever it was moving to the right, Nasruddin would say, push it to the right, push it to the right. And Nasruddin would say, what do you say that for? He said, look, he's a teenager. If you say push it to the left, I know he'll push it to the right. If I say push it to the right, he'll push it to the left. So if it's leading to the left, I always tell him to push it to the left. So that makes a lot of sense. But then one day, the teenager was taking the donkey across the rope bridge, and it was leaning to the right, and the father said, push it to the right. And the teenager did, and it fell in, lost all the salt, and the donkey as well. What are you that for? He said, oh, I've grown up now. So sometimes even the information we give, it depends. Because when you grow up, you don't have to sort of disobey your parents anymore. The point is that sometimes even the advice we sometimes misunderstand, or we don't really understand what the true instructions are. So even listen to somebody else, sometimes we get the wrong impression. So a lot of times we have to find out our experience, and it's experience which becomes one's teacher. Very often I taught people, when they say, where can I learn more about the teachings? Where can I really read the teachings of the Buddha? And I say, all you need to do is to read your own heart, and you find all the teachings in there. And for anybody who wants to really challenge me on this, there is actually a teaching, a sutta of the Buddha, a saying of the Buddha, where he said that all the teachings of the Buddha, rather the beginning and the end of the world, can all be found inside your own body and mind. Very powerful teaching. It can all be found inside your own body and mind. And this is actually why we always rely upon experience in Buddhism. But we have to be careful, because everyone says they rely upon experience, but sometimes we get it wrong. And it's interesting to see why we get it wrong. But before I go on to why we get things wrong, why our experience is not truthful to the reality, I also mention just a little bit more about like beliefs. Because when we're believing, we're taking what somebody else says, we're taking what the book says. And there's one very famous teaching in Buddhism, which many people celebrate, called the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha actually went to this group of people called the Kalamas. It's the name of a village, so just the villagers in that particular town. And these people had had so many other teachers coming through that they got a bit bored, they got a bit confused. Who's right and who's wrong? Now you say you're right and somebody else says they're right and somebody else says you're wrong, I'm the only person who's right. How can we know? And that's actually like our present day. And we have so many different religions, so many different truths and philosophies are in the supermarket of religion. So why come here? Why not go down to the temple next door or to the church or go to anything? Why? And of course, what the Buddha actually said, look, don't go and believe anybody, don't go and believe me. Test it out and use your experience for a guide, because experience is the most important. But you've got to be careful with your experience, because sometimes even experience can lie. What we mean there about experience lying is we can mishear, we can missee, we can get things wrong. Even though we think we know, we just make an assumption which really isn't true. I gave a talk about that a couple of weeks ago, about assumptions. And just how, you know, we believe in something and it doesn't actually turn out to be true. For example, some of our expectations about ourselves. I'm not sure, did I tell the story recently about the... I know I told a story, I think, in a meditation retreat, which I gave in North Perth. But did I tell the story about the monk who wasn't afraid of tigers? Was that in a retreat? I think you were on a retreat, but I don't think I told it here. It actually shows how we can get things wrong. This is actually an old Thai forest story from the Thai forest monks, because the one who told me this was a monk called Ajahn Juan. Just before he died, he told me this story. Because I went to visit him in this remote monastery in the northeast of Thailand. And I'd only been there that night. I was just going to pay respects. And in a monastery close by, a big wild elephant had come into the monastery. And the so-called abbot of this monastery was so scared, he actually jumped out of his window, which was about 2 or 3 meters above the ground. Because the elephants can actually destroy a hut very easily. And the elephants in Thailand are quite dangerous. Now sometimes, actually there was one friend of mine who was sitting in meditation, and the elephant put the trunk around him and actually moved him. So he was in the way, and unfortunately he got quite badly injured. So the elephants weren't all that sort of tender with the monk. So the elephants can be quite dangerous. And so he turned to me and he said, do you want to go to that monastery and see the elephants? I said, yeah, I'll go there. And he just laughed. And he said, are you afraid of elephants? I said, no. But the point was, I was just making an assumption. Who knows whether they're afraid of elephants or not? And that's why they told this story. He told me the story of the monk who wasn't afraid of tigers. This monk who was on wandering in part of Thailand came to a certain village in the afternoon. Usually you actually check in with the headman of the village, you know, before you actually go and stay there. Because the headman will tell you if there's any dangers there. And also you'd have to tell the village to expect the monk for alms round the following morning for the meal. The villagers would be very happy to give you something to eat, but they wanted to know you were coming first. So he checked in with the headman of the village late one afternoon and said he was staying in the jungle close by. And the headman said, oh, you better be very careful. There's a very dangerous tiger in this vicinity who's eaten many water buffaloes and also many children. And I'm sure he would like a nice fat monk like you. Or something like that. But the monk said, I'm a forest monk. I'm a tough dude. I'm not afraid of tigers. Bring them on. Yes, yeah, said the headman. Yes, yeah, said the monk. And so, with some other villagers, they took this monk through a path which went into the jungle, where the tiger track crossed that path. You know, in the jungles, it's very clear to know where the tiger tracks are. They make their own little roads through the jungles. And this was a big and dangerous tiger. Are you sure, said the headman? Yes, yeah, said the monk. So they put his mosquito net umbrella really close by to the tiger trail. And then they left him alone all night to meditate next to the trail of this monk-eating tiger. Now, monks of our tradition, when we meditate, we don't always just meditate just on the breath. One of the famous meditation techniques in our tradition is actually to use mantras. Mantras are a group of words which we use to try and hold our attention onto the breath. And one of the most common is the mantra called Buddho, like the Buddha, where you breathe in, you say to yourself, Bud, as you breathe out, Tho, Buddho, Buddho, like that. And that's what this monk was doing. He was doing a mantra Buddho along with the breath. And as you get quiet, the breath becomes very soft and very smooth. And the monk was just sitting there, just doing his little mantra with the breath. Buddho. Buddho. So peaceful. So calm. Buddho. Late into the night. Until he heard a sound. It was a sound of the jungle animals. Because that's the time when the jungle animals start to move around. And it was quite automatic. He didn't plan this, but he noticed he was chanting, Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. And as the sound came closer, he realized that this was quite a large jungle animal. Buddho, 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 Buddho. And so he decided to open his eyes. And as he opened his eyes, he saw this huge tiger coming in his direction. And at that, his mantra changed. Along with the breath, he found himself saying, Tiger, 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 tiger. And as it came closer, according to the tale which I was told, he didn't know how it happened, but in a moment, he had dived out from underneath a mosquito net and was running away. He forgot all of his mindfulness except for one thing, his mantra, Tiger, 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 as he went and ran for safety to the village. Now, it's against the rules for monks to run. And you know why? Because the robes we wear are not made to run in. They're only held together just by a few clever folds or just, you know, a few neat tucks here and there. And what happens when you run with these robes? First of all, they come loose. Then bits of robe tend to trail behind. And then eventually the whole robe trails a long way behind. And by the time this monk came into this village, doing his mantra at the top of his voice, Tiger, 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 he exposed some naked truths. He showed all the villagers who he woke up the bare facts, the big monk. He was nude, he was naked. And of course, the villagers never let him forget that. He became famous and they told the neighbouring villagers and all the monks, it became one of the little stories, the true stories, about the monk who was not afraid of tigers. The point is, until we actually meet a tiger, we don't know whether we are afraid. It's only experience itself can tell us the truth. When I was in Melbourne, I've only just recently returned yesterday from a trip to Melbourne, giving some talks, we started talking about, are you afraid of death? Are you afraid of death? You don't know until death comes up. Some even monks say, I'm not afraid of death. But when death comes, only then will you truly know. It's only the experience, not the theory, which we have to go on. Because the theory or our ideas and our assumptions so often are untrustworthy. Especially if we haven't got a means to really know what experience truly is. Because sometimes our experience of life, you know, we think we know, but the truth of the matter is very, very different. You know that before I became a monk, I was a teacher, but before a teacher I was a scientist. And one of the pieces of science I loved more than anything else was quantum physics or quantum mechanics. Because that really tested my assumptions about what nature really was. Because it's very, very weird and very, very strange. And one of those experiments, or one of those parts of quantum physics which showed me how strange the world was and how I made so much assumptions and how my experience of the world was actually not was actually what was actually out there, was the story of Schrödinger's cat. I like cats, but this physicist did a very mean thing to his cat. He put this cat in a box. In that box was a little vial of cyanide, which would kill that cat if it was smashed. And next to that vial there was some sort of device, some atomic device, and if the particular atoms decayed, then the vial would be smashed. If they didn't decay, it would not be smashed, and the cat would live. It was a 50% chance that the vial would be smashed, 50% chance that it wouldn't. And the point was, according to the reality of science, undisputed, absolute reality, until he opened the box, it's not that he couldn't tell whether the cat was alive or the cat had died, that the cat was neither alive nor dead. According to the most rigorous, perfect of sciences, that cat was in some realm where he was neither alive nor dead. And that was actually the truth of things. It belies our experience. Our experience says it shouldn't be that way. And even those of you who know some of the stories of science know that Einstein just could not accept that, but Einstein was proved wrong. That is true. It's lasted the tests of science for the last 50 or so years or more. So the world is much more different than we really think. Sometimes our experience is not the way things truly are. Sometimes our assumptions are not the truth. And an interesting understanding of this, because somebody else also asked me, can I mention the Buddhist idea of reincarnation or rebirth? To some, that's so obvious. To others, it's completely unacceptable. And some people say, how can you know anyway? There was one monk years ago was asked, do you believe in rebirth? He said, no. Why? Because I haven't died yet, he said. However, that was wrong. Because he had died, he'd just forgotten, that's all. But how do we know that? How can we actually know whether that's true or not? But what's really interesting to me is not really whether reincarnation is true or not, but why sometimes people believe in reincarnation when they don't really know. Why some people don't believe in it when, again, they don't really know. What's really fascinating to me is how we form our ideas and opinions. Is it really on experience or is it not? And to illustrate this, I'm going to tell a story of many, many years ago when I was the second monk, and Ajahn Chakra, who's the abbot at that time, the teacher, sent me to give a talk at a school. So I decided to go. I didn't got much choice if I wanted to keep out of trouble with the boss monk at that time. So I went to give the talk, and I found out only when I got there it was a primary school, and it was to year twos. And I thought, my goodness, how can I give a talk on the Four Noble Truths or reincarnation, all this, or the voidness of everything? How can I do this, the nature of non-self, to a group of two-year-olds? So I started thinking quickly, and I was talking about this and that and the other to try and get them interested. And then I asked them a question. I said, how many of you like rice? No, how many of you don't like rice pudding? That was a question I asked them. How many of you don't like rice pudding? And then this, I think it was two class of year twos, with the parents and the teachers at the back just wondering what I was doing. About three or four children put their hands up. They did not like rice pudding. And you see all the other sort of year twos, they were looking around and they saw these three or four people putting up their hands. And so they put up their hands as well. And others looked around. And it only took about 60 seconds, and about 60 year twos, maybe not that many, about 50, had all put their hands up, yes, we don't like rice pudding. I said, okay, put your hands down, children. Now can you put your hands up if you've ever eaten rice pudding? and only about 6 children put their hands up. Everybody laughed, and I taught a very profound piece of Buddhism. Isn't it the case that so often that many of our ideas we just take from others? How often is it when I tell the stories about what I used to eat in Thailand, you know, like frog soup or frog on rice? I've told that story so many times, I'm not going to repeat it here. But how many times people say, ugh, yuck, you know, frog soup. What about, I don't think I told the time when we had bat's head. Have you ever seen a bat's head? The most ugliest of things you can ever imagine. Do you think you, would you like bat's head? Okay, people have been wagging their heads, they don't like bat's head. How many people here have ever eaten bat's head? Now do you get the point? I've just taught you Buddhism. We all assume it's terrible, it's nasty, but we haven't tried it yet. You're not going on experience, it's just belief. Actually, it does taste disgusting. But you don't know that. And if you don't know that, how can you judge it now? You understand the problem with experience and our ideas and views. Too often, we get these ideas and views, and many of them are culturally conditioned. We think that bat's heads would be awful. Look at the cheese which we eat, mouldy old cheese with green bits growing on it. That's happened many times when I was a young monk. Sometimes your parents or somebody would actually visit and they'd bring you all these delicious cheeses, you know, from England. And I remember once, it wasn't actually me, myself, it was one of my friends who was staying in Bangkok. Somebody, a rich person, came and offered them some cheeses. Stilton's and Gorgonzola, a bit of camembert, lots of really nice stuff. And they gave it to one of the temple attendants to put in the refrigerator for the following day. And the following day for lunch, they asked, bring out the cheeses. And the temple boy said, I've thrown them away. Why? He said, they'd gone off. They're supposed to be like that. And you could understand how anyone in their right mind could eat that sort of stuff. But you can. Why is it? It's just conditioning, that's all. Whether we like it or we don't like it, that's all it is. You know that it's part of a standing joke in my monastery. You know that two of my most favorite smells, which makes me feel just so comfortable, one of them is like tar, and the other one is batshit. You know when I smell that, I feel so happy. One of them is because when I was young, and I used to play soccer in the local park, because in the Second World War, they'd used all the iron railings to build tanks and shells. And so they'd taken all the iron railings from all the parks in London and other places and replaced them with wooden stakes in order for them to be able to maintain themselves in that climate. They used to paint them with tar every year. And so that the smell of tar was the smell of my childhood. And I had some wonderful times in that park. So whenever I smell tar, it's just psychologically it feels really good for me. And there's a saying that some of these monasteries where I went to, one in particular, had this beautiful cave, and I used to spend so many happy hours meditating in that cave, and I made sometimes all day. And there were so many bats in there, and the whole place smelled of bat shit. And so whenever I smelled bat shit, that's so wonderful. It's true. So it's just conditioning, that's all. What we like, what we don't like. So what is actually true? What isn't true? Sometimes it's just our conditioning, that's all. A lot of times it's what we want to believe becomes what is true. And that's why a lot of times our experience should be really questioned. What our experience is, what's actually out there and what happens when it gets into our brain, is that the same? Does batshit smell fragrant? Do bats' heads are delicious? How do we know? Now the point is that in Buddhism, the Buddha gave these great teachings. If anyone's listening to this on tape, it's called the Vipalasas. It's a way that our perceptions bend the truth. What we actually experience is actually not accurate to what's out there. We actually filter out things. What we don't want to see, we will never see. What challenges our views and opinions, we will just reject out of hand. We just cannot see it. And I say this, if a UFO landed outside, right now. If that just challenges your belief system so much, you would not be able to accept it. When this little man in green came out with little tentacles and said, "Take me to your leader," you would think it was some sort of movie being on, or somebody was playing a joke, or one of these organizations that dialed a telegram and you sort of get UFOs or Martians to sort of come and play a joke on somebody. You will not believe it because it's just too hard to believe. It goes against your belief system. Even if it was true, you would not accept it. It's called denial, isn't it? It's a very famous part of psychology. So, if there is such a thing as, say, reincarnation, is the very fact that some people can't accept it just denial? It's just too hard to accept because it challenges too much of what we think about life. It challenges our views. It challenges even our comfort zone. Because if there is such a thing as reincarnation, and you have to come back here again, then you are not done with nappies and school. You have to face that all over again. Imagine once more having a dummy put in your mouth to stop you crying. It's not a nice thought. So, for some people, it's not just worse than that. The very idea of coming back again, so sometimes it's so horrendous, they just will not accept it, even though it might be true. And I've said here, and if anyone likes to look at the evidence, there is heaps of evidence out there for the truth of rebirth. And basically, that, now having been a scientist before, if anybody is reasonable, is rational, and they look at that evidence out there, it's blooming convincing. Very, very convincing. It cannot be explained by other ways. Look at the works by Ian Stevenson, which I think we have in our library here. Somebody got us a signed copy of Dr. Ian Stevenson's work. No, Professor Ian Stevenson's work. He is a man who spent his whole life researching people who spontaneously remembered their past lives. And one of the fascinating quirks of our human world that his research into reincarnation got a sponsor from a very famous company in the US. And that company was Xerox. The photocopying people wanted to find out about reincarnation. They were the ones who was bankrolling him. And he got many, many sort of results from his work. And there's many other places where you can get results about reincarnation or rebirth. So why is it that some people refuse to even acknowledge it as a possibility? Why is it uncomfortable for people to understand that? They're not going on experience because they don't know yet. But sometimes it's because our likes and dislikes get threatened. The philosophical consequences of such a belief are such we don't really want to accept it. Sometimes it's just too hard. There's too much about truth which we don't want to see. So when we talk about experience, we just cannot sometimes trust our experience. What we say, what we think. If you believe that bat's head doesn't taste nice, as soon as you have bat's head on your plate, you think, "Oh, this is going to taste awful, this is going to taste awful," and it does taste awful because you made it taste awful. You've actually made the world fit what you expected it to be. Now, how much else of our world do we actually just change to suit ourselves? Isn't that a beautiful sound, the mobile phone? Why do some people hate that sound? Just conditioning, that's all. What's wrong with that sound? See that too much of our judgments of others are all conditioned, what's good and what's bad. Where does all that come from? What is good, what is bad? Where does that all come from? A lot of it is just conditioned. So, here. Condition means it's implanted by someone else. We're just sheep. We just do what other people do. So, we have a wonderful way of understanding just how truthful experience can actually be perceived. Because all of our experience gets bent by likes and dislikes. where we take away likes and dislikes. Only then does our experience become truthful, does it become valid. It's the likes and dislikes which stop us seeing the truth. So we have this practice in Buddhism called meditation. Meditation is where we let go temporarily of our likes and dislikes. Technically it's called overcoming the five hindrances. The five hindrances are not just hindrances to becoming still in meditation. They're a hindrance which block wisdom, which stop you seeing the truth. That's why they're called hindrances. In brief, those five hindrances are desire. Second one is ill will. Those are the two main ones. There's sloth and sloth when you're just so dozy you can't really understand what's going on. The other one was restlessness when you're moving your mind all over the place, you're never still enough to see anything truthfully. You're going too fast. And the fifth one is doubt. Sometimes the people have got so much doubt, even if it's right there in front of you, you say, it can't be true. It can't be true. You're just doubting when it really is. Instead of thinking about it, you should be looking. Those are the five hindrances. These are the things which bend the truth so we can't trust experience. And you can see what desire is. Vested interests. Desire. That's why sometimes you can't even trust science. Because there's too much vested interest in science. I think only recently I think that the journals, I think like Nature and like Scientific American, actually insisted that all of the people who submitted papers for publication told who paid for that research. Because there was a case many years ago where some research was done which showed that smoking cigarettes stop you getting Alzheimer's disease. There was a strong correlation from the research that people who smoked did not get Alzheimer's disease. Until somebody found that was sponsored by cigarette companies. And they looked at the research a bit deeper and they found it was just that people did not live long enough to get Alzheimer's disease when they smoked. Now it's easy to prove things like that if you really want to. But sometimes you're bending the truth. And the point is there that sometimes you're telling people what they want to believe and yeah, they'll believe that. That's why people shop around, for people to tell them, you know, what they want to hear. Sometimes that's one of the problems. People actually shop around sometimes for counselors or therapists. They shop for this one and that one and that one and this one. And when the counselor tells them what they want to hear, oh, they understand me. And they go back again. So sometimes you've got to be very careful there. Because sometimes you can respect people who tell you what you don't want to hear. Because sometimes that's the truth and you need to hear it. Sometimes the truth, the real truth, is sometimes unpleasant. I remember reading an article once about this man who had, he was actually in, it wasn't in Perth, it was in some other state, but in the equivalent of Greylands, which was, you know, the hospital for those with some mental disturbance. And like many people who I visited over there, everyone I visited over there said, I don't know what I'm doing in here. Everyone else is crazy in this place. What am I doing in here? And the reason is because you're crazy too. That's why. But this man was being visited by a friend. And the friend had the courage to tell this inmate of this mental institution. He said, you're mad. You're crazy. And in this little article which I read, he said, that was the first time that this man in this institution realized that he too was the same as all the others. That he too was crazy. He'd been in denial. You think everyone else was crazy, but he was okay. And he said that he had so much gratitude in the later part of his life for that best friend who'd actually told him the truth rather than just, you know, trying to tell him what he wanted to hear. He told him the truth. You're crazy. You're mad. Because that was a start of his recovery. Once he realized he had a problem, then he started doing something about it. And eventually he got through that problem and lived a normal, very successful life. But how many of us have got the guts to tell our friends, you know, you're crazy, you're mad? Because we always tell them, or we want to tell them, what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear. It's this wanting business that actually stops the truth from being seen or being known. Or it's the ill will. You know, we just cannot see things sometimes. It's just so unpleasant to see this. And that happens so often in illnesses in particular. How many people actually get sudden heart attacks? And they seem to be so healthy and they suddenly just drop down dead. Are they really sudden? I don't think they are sudden. I think that they've been hearing, or rather the body's been telling, giving the signals for a long time. But in denial, you can't hear them, you can't see them. Because the fact that you're in ill health is just too bad. It's too awful for you. You just cannot see it. You cannot hear it. So it's only when we're truthful that we actually can really look after our body. So being in denial is actually not seeing the truth. And again, when we have this sloth and torpor, this dullness, and actually that's for most people in this world, they live in dullness. Their experience is only just half of what's really happening. So give you a simile which works very well. It's an old simile which I've used many times. It's a simile of my monastery in Serpentine, 2 kilometres up a hill. I was going up there for about 10 years in a car, up and down, up and down, up and down. One day I decided to walk up that hill. When I walked up the hillside looked very different. I'd never seen the hillside like that before. When I stopped, it looked even more beautiful, more rich, more detail. And I reflected on why that happened. Why that happened, this actually shows why a lot of times we don't understand the true experience. When you're going in a car, you're going so fast, what you see hasn't got time to imprint itself on your senses. All you see is flashes of what's happening. How can you really know? How can you take that momentary experience of being truth? The only time you really understand a hillside like that is to go slow, to have the time to see everything which is happening there. Many of you have heard that story before, but how many of you have actually walked up and down your street where you live, slowly, instead of getting in your car and driving backwards and forwards? How many of you even actually walked around this park in front? If you walk around this park, you'll find it's very, very different than you've ever seen before. It's strange and fascinating what happens when you slow down. Because what it's doing, it's giving you an experience of what is happening when you slow down. When you slow down, you see much more, you see more deeply into things, and it always happens. What you see is more beautiful. It's full of more happiness and joy. Restlessness, or sloth and torpor, they both work together. Sometimes we're so tired, we can't really see clearly, our senses are dull. Sometimes we're going so fast, we haven't got time to see things. So how much of our life have we truly understood? How much experience has been valid, and how much have been, it's just partial experience, we rush past and we don't really know what's gone on. We've been going too fast. Which is why we have our meditation to slow down. We have our meditation to get rid of likes and dislikes, but to see what's there. When we see what's there, when we have no likes and dislikes, when we slow down, we start to have truthful experience, not only of the world, but of ourselves. If you are going to be someone who creates things, or invents things, or finds deeper secrets, this is actually how you do it. Creativity will come out of silence. Creativity will come out of times when you slow down, when the mind starts to stop, where you start to see more fully into things. Where experience becomes much closer to truth. The faster you are, the further you are from truth and reality. The slower you go, the deeper you see. One of the reasons why we have so much problems in our modern world, we go so fast we don't even know what we're doing. And that's why actually another email came through. They wanted me to give a Buddhist comment about the abuse of prisoners in Iraq. People are out of control. They don't know what they're doing. I'm sure that some of those, these soldiers, I think British soldiers as well as American soldiers, when they look back at what they did, they wonder, why did I do that? What was happening? They're out of control. How many of you are out of control? We're not really knowing what we're doing, just responding so quickly, not really understanding what's truth. Because when we just stop and look at that, that's horrendous. Why on earth could anybody do that? It seems ridiculous. But don't think those people who, those soldiers in charge of the prisoners, were any different than you or I. When we're going fast and speeding and not having time, it's amazing just how we can misunderstand what's really going on. And how in particular natural compassion which comes out of a human heart, which will never allow that to be done to any human being, how that through the perversion of our perception, not seeing really clearly, not understanding what we're doing, how we can actually misbehave like that. That's why it's more important to slow down, to stop, and to get into real experience, valid experience. So actually you would know, you'd feel that that is wrong, I just cannot do that. I was quoting a little book review which I read a long time ago, written by, I think, an English general, a soldier, who was not only experienced through his own career, but also read widely on military history and military ideas. And one thing which he wrote in that particular essay, which was really interested me, was saying that how hard it was in armies to get the soldiers to actually fight. He said all the training in the world would sometimes be useless, that when the soldiers in his army were facing the enemy, when you actually saw someone rushing towards you about to kill you and you had a gun, he said you wouldn't believe just how many soldiers would refuse to actually pull the trigger and kill the person coming towards them, even though it meant that they would have to die. That sometimes that seeing somebody else's face, seeing another human being there, you just cannot kill them. He said so many soldiers in battle would actually have the ability to defend themselves but would not take that opportunity, would rather die. He said part of the art of being a soldier is trying to convince or condition soldiers to actually pull that trigger. A lot of them just won't do it. It's interesting just how there is something inside of ourselves, some real experience which we call compassion or kindness. When we slow down, when we look, when we feel what's happening inside of ourselves, when we go to the truth of experience, but not just experience which is bent out of desire or ill will or out of fear, when there's none of those hindrances there, and we go to bare experience, that's wise, that's compassionate, that's soft, that's loving, that's forgiving. So when we're talking about experience, those are the experiences which we should develop and we should trust. The experiences which come from a calm, peaceful heart. When we come from those experiences, then I think our human race has an opportunity, has a chance of actually healing the wounds of our planet and healing the rifts in our societies. If we can only trust in that experience, then how on earth could we ever kill anybody? How can we abuse somebody? How never could we even shout at our husband or wife? How ever could we get angry when we go to the experience in our hearts? You'd notice whenever you get angry, you're forgetting about how you feel. You're just focusing on that trigger outside of you. That person who's made you angry, or that situation which has upset you. As long as you keep thinking about that person or that situation, what we call the trigger of your anger, as long as you keep looking at that, the anger will continue. But if you stop looking at that and feel your own heart, how you're experiencing it when you shout at other people, it's a rotten feeling. And you would never do it if you could only see what's happening inside of you. If you just check your own experience of the world as you act and you work through this world and you feel how you're feeling when you're doing this, when you're saying that, when you're acting in that particular way, if you could only understand how you felt inside, that would be the best indicator of what's right and wrong. That would be what stops you doing harmful and hurtful things. We can only trust ourselves. Too often we do hurtful and harmful things because we're afraid, we're escaping from reality. And sometimes people say, oh, you monks, you're just escaping from reality. No, you're the ones escaping from reality. They're watching movies and just watching TV and just running here and running there. To face reality, we have to stop. That's why many people have gone on meditation retreats or spent time in a monastery. They've got nowhere to run away to anymore. There's no movies, there's no TV. Even the fridge is out of bounds. You can't go and look in there and find something to eat. You're stuck all afternoon and evening, not eating anything, stuck in your room. Nothing to do, nowhere to go. Why did you want to go anywhere anyway? Why are we wanting to do it? Just trying to escape from yourself, trying to escape from the reality of this. So when we slow down and stop, our experience becomes of this. What's happening now? You. Life. In this moment. When you're meditating, could you stay still? If not, why not? What's wrong with staying still? Why can't we just rest in peace? Why is that so difficult? Because we've always been on the run. Our experience is never of this, it's always of something else. Some fantasy in the future. We think that once we get our cake, then we can eat it. We want it both ways. We're always running away. If you come into the present moment, you find you've got all the cake you ever want there. And you can eat it at the same time. Because now is the eating. And the cake is in your heart right now. The beautiful fruit cake, which is you. Whatever other cake you like. This is a cake of Dhamma, the cake of truth. The cake which is your experience in the moment. You're experiencing it now. It's strange that having our cake and eat it, we just want to actually to amass happiness. This is what that actually similarly means, to have your cake and eat it. It means you've got this beautiful cake, you want to keep it there so you can eat it in the future, but you want to eat it now. If you eat it now, you haven't got it in later on. If you keep it for later on, you're not eating it now. So you've got this terrible thing, should I have it now, should I have it later on? A lot of times people do that. Sometimes they just have their happiness now and they've got nothing left later on. Sometimes they just, you know, enjoy, live for the day. And they've found they've got nothing in the larder tomorrow because they haven't been to work. Sometimes they put off happiness into the future. That's like having your cake and keeping your cake. Always happiness tomorrow. I'll do this and then I'll be happy. Sort of, I'll get married, then I'll be happy. I'll retire, then I'll be happy. I'll become enlightened, then I'll be happy. I'll go to heaven, then I'll be happy. Whatever it is, at some time in the future, you'll be happy. Are you? Have you ever noticed just how that's just a delusion? We never get happy that way. So how can you have your cake and eat it? You'll find all the happiness you ever want in the world. Immense happiness. You don't have to keep it. Because keeping things is wrong. In other words, the more you keep, the more pain you have. You don't have to keep anything. It's the keeping which is a problem. The cake is always there if you don't keep it. One of my similes, which I said recently in Melbourne, actually yesterday I think, no, the day before, in Melbourne, was the simile of my mother's mantle shelf. Simile of my mother's mantle shelf. My mother's flat in London, she's got a shelf which was supposed to be above a fire, but they don't have a fire there anymore, just have an electric heater. There was an old feature in homes which used to have coal fires or wood fires. Above the coal wood fire there'll be a shelf, and on that shelf you put photographs, knickknacks, the photos of when you got married or your children or whatever. When I first went to see my mother in London from Australia, of course I gave her a gift. I gave her a little furry stuffed kangaroo, which you get from the shops, you know, a nice cuddly toy. My mother loved it, a nice cuddly kangaroo, so that when I left she could think of Australia and where I was. And so she put that cuddly kangaroo on her mantel shelf. A few years later I visited her again, and this time I bought her a koala, and she put it next to the kangaroo. 3 days later I visited a third time and bought her a koala. No, a koala, a kookaburra. And she put that next to the other two animals. And then One year when I went to visit her, I brought her a wombat. They're quite big too, but it's nice and furry and cuddly. And so when I gave her the wombat, she put it on the mantel shelf. But by now there were so many things on that mantel shelf. When she put the wombat on, quite a few other things fell off. And so she spent a long time trying to balance everything on this overfull mantel shelf she had. And that you can see what the simile was. I told my mother, why didn't you throw some of those things away? Throw the old kangaroo and the kookaburra and the koala away. So you can put a wombat on there. He said, no, I can't. This mean a lot to me. And that photograph of that, and this is what my your brother gave me when he visited Switzerland, and this is what somebody gave me when they came from Canada, and this is what they gave. It had so many mementos on there that they couldn't get everything on that mantel shelf. Things kept falling off. I told him that's a simile of a mental breakdown. When you've got so much stuff in there that you put one more thing on, it's just everything falls off. And you know how to overcome mental breakdowns. Just clean your shelf off. Throw a few things away. Why are you keeping so much stuff on there? Can't you throw things away of your life? What's happened in the past? He said this, she said that. This happened to me, that happened to me. My goodness, even one day of mental shelf business is enough to give you a mental breakdown. So throw it all away, leave it alone, for goodness sake. It was a very good simile. But why did my mother keep on keeping those things? Oh, because they were important. They meant a lot to me. It wasn't just good stuff on there. She also had some rubbish stuff up there as well, some bills which she had to pay in the next few weeks. So she kept that on her mantel shelf. Throw those away as well. I said, you're over 70 now. You don't put people in jail when they're over 70. But anyhow. So we can actually see that it's a throwing things away. That's the reason why we can't sort of just relax in the present moment. Just why we come to like bare experience. Ajahn Chah told a lovely story about how we understand life and experience. Because he's in our monasteries in northeast Thailand. We're in jungles, in forests. And actually to get from one hut to another, we'd make paths in those forests and we'd sweep them every day. We'd sweep them free of leaves. So when we were walking backwards and forwards, we could actually see if there's any snakes or centipedes or scorpions or these black ants, which would really bite you very badly, on the path. So we could actually see them and actually avoid them. And these actually paths in these forest monasteries were like just, because the sand was white underneath, like white rivers, you know, flowing through the forest. They're very beautiful. But when it came to sweep, we used to sweep every day. When we were sweeping, sometimes we'd be sweeping a path, and you turn around and a leaf would fall on this beautifully, freshly swept path. And so, you know, being a perfectionist, I'd go back and sweep it away again. And you're always sort of going back on your work. But Ajahn Chah gave this wonderful simile. He said, why is it that when one leaf falls on a path, it really stands out? If one leaf falls in a forest where there's many leaves, you don't notice it. He said, that's like life. When there's so many things happening, it's like so many leaves in the forest, you can't figure out the meaning of any one of them. When you swept the path clean, and just one leaf falls down, it stands out so easily, you can really understand its meaning and its truth. One of our problems is our experiences are just like leaves in the forest. There's too many of them. We can't really understand what's going on. Just like my mother's mantel shelf, there's so much stuff up there that you put one thing on there, everything else falls off, and it all sort of, one thing on there just disappears amongst a mass of other stuff. If we really want to have experience which can tell us the truth of things, we have to actually sweep off our mantel shelf, empty it out, and then when a wombat goes on to the top there, it's just one wombat, and it's clean of all this other stuff. You can actually see it, you can experience it, you can enjoy it, you can understand it, because it's alone and free. Now can you understand why our experiences, we can never really understand what's going on. We've got so much stuff, and it's never really alone and free. It's all sort of complicated with other stuff. So if we really want to trust our experience, it's not just getting rid of those five hindrances. It's getting what we call in Buddhism, one-pointedness of mind. Just one thing in the mind. Not two, not three, but just one thing. This. And if we've got a nice, clear, and empty mind, not too much going on, then we can understand what this experience truly is. Too much complexity in our world means our experience is just tangled. When we untangle that experience, then we can find out the truth of things. And the best experience of all is the truth of happiness. Sometimes our happiness is so complicated because things are moving too fast. So many things are happening. But you don't just get one happiness, one thing. Which is why we meditate, just to get one pointedness of mind. One thing happening. And see that as we empty the mantle shelves of our poor brains. Free them from the complexities. When sometimes it feels like that, doesn't it? One more thing you put in your brain and everything sort of tumbles down and all gets mixed up. You don't know where you are. Keep it free. Keep it empty. And then you can truly trust the experiences of your life. So when we talk about experiences or enjoying the cake and eating at the same time, this is actually by letting go of the past, letting go of the future, and being the present. You find there's always a nice kangaroo on your mantel shelf, or a wombat. Who cares what it is? Just one thing. Who cares what type of cake? You don't have to keep the old cake, because cakes are being delivered every moment of your life. That's how we can enjoy the cake and eat it. We eat this moment, and there's another moment coming right behind. We don't need to keep anything. The less you have, the more you can enjoy. That's how to have your cake and eat it. Look at the monks. The monks don't have any money. Sister doesn't have any money. But we get cakes almost every day. We've given up cakes. And that's why we get lots of cakes. You know, there is some... Because, you know, I came from the Thai tradition. There are a group of Thai Christian nuns in a Carmelite convent south of Bunbury. And some of the Thai people here, because they're Thais, doesn't matter if you're Buddhist, they can still go and give nice gifts to these poor Thais in this convent. It's an enclosed convent. You can't actually go in there. If you want to visit, actually it's like being in prison. You go to a grill, and they're on the other side. You can actually talk through the grill. And I remember one of these Thais went up to Bunbury, and they made them a nice chocolate cake. You know, like something special. You know, like, you know, if you're going to go, you know, to a friend or someone you respect, even like to the monks, you always want to give something special. That's one of the troubles, that, you know, when people actually bring food to the monks, it's always something special. It's just so hard to get simple food. We used to get into trouble this when in the early days, when they'd come and give food to the monks, you know, especially the Thai women. And the husband would come with them and complain. Say, she never gives such food to me. Say, because you're not a monk, that's why. So he used to get the best of it. Anyway, so they brought the chocolate cake to these nuns. And when actually they offered, you know, through the school, this chocolate cake, the nun just, you know, forgot her mindfulness and said, oh no, not another chocolate cake. Because they're getting chocolate cakes every day, just like we do. So, if you want to have your cake and eat it, then be a monk or be a nun. And that's the answer to that question. In other words, give up things and you have everything come to you. The more you give up, the more you get. So, and it's true, if you give up seeking for happiness, if you give up the search, if you give up wanting it out there, wanting it out here, give up searching, then happiness comes to you. You find it was searching was what was actually taking you away from happiness. As a Chinese saying says, so the hungry man was looking for fire, looking for a flame to cook his evening meal, only was looking for flame with a candle. If he only knew what flame was, he could have cooked his dinner much earlier. Very profound story. You can imagine this man with a candle looking for fire here, looking for fire there. If he only realized what flame was, he had a flame all the time. We're looking for happiness here, we're looking for happiness there. If we only realized we had that happiness inside of us, that which is looking is the flame, then we could cook our dinner much, much earlier. We could have our cake and eat it at the same time, every moment of our lives. And that is the experience of coming in to the present moment, giving up these five hindrances, coming into oneness, coming into happiness, finding the Nibbana cake and eating it. So somehow or other I managed to combine experience and having your cake and eating it, and a few other things as well. So I hope you enjoyed the talk this evening. So thank you. Now, are there any questions about this evening's talk? Yeah, got one from the back over there. Yes. What happens if there's a serious concern in the life? You actually find out what that concern is. If there's something you can do about it, you give it everything you've got. If there's nothing you can do about it, you do nothing. Some serious concerns you can't do anything about. So you leave them. You make peace with them. There's some concerns where you have responsibility and duty. You do something. One of my stories actually came from the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, who during the Six Days' War, where Israel was fighting Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, a few other countries as well probably, that the British Prime Minister was asked by a reporter what he thought about the war in the Middle East, or the problem in the Middle East, I think was the words. And this British statesman said, there is no problem in the Middle East. Very powerful statement. He said, there is no problem in the Middle East. And the journalist said, what do you mean? There's no problem in the Middle East. Don't you know there's a war going on? People are killing themselves. And this British statesman replied, sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it's not a problem. Now, that's actually a very, very profound statement. He had to be efficient with all the responsibilities he had. For him, things which had a solution, had an answer, where he could do something. That was his problem. That's where he worked. That's where he thought. That's where he exercised his mind and every other ability he had. When there was nothing to do. And, you know, it was true. There was no solution. He couldn't do anything. Therefore, it wasn't a problem. So if you have something happening to you and there's nothing you can do, it's not a problem. It may be unpleasant, but, as you've heard me say here before, unpleasant situations in life are like stepping in the dog poo. They're smelly, they're unpleasant, and you wish you hadn't have done it. But there it is, the dog poo is on your sandals or even on your feet, because sometimes monks go barefooted. Even the kangaroo poo. Some very, very devoted person once came to my monastery and decided to bow to the monks on the road. Without looking what they were doing, they put their head into kangaroo poo. They bowed in the poo. Now the point is, sometimes that's what life is. So what do you do with the kangaroo poo? If you complain about it, get upset about it, get angry about it, you're not realizing that kangaroo poo should be taken back and put in your rose garden, put in your mango, under your mango tree. And always remember that mango trees love dog poo. And whenever you taste that mango when it's ripe, remember that's what you're tasting. All that sweetness came from the dog poo. It does. It goes in there and it becomes mango. So in that simile, if there's a really serious crisis or problem in your life, there's something you can do about it, fine. If not, dig it in. Dig into your life. Learn compassion, learn wisdom, learn endurance. Whatever that crisis is there to teach you, it is fertilizer for your spiritual life. It's unpleasant at the time, but don't worry about it. Dig it in. And you'll find at the end of that cycle, you'll be so grateful for the crises you had in life. When used wisely, they're fertilizer, making you a wonderful, more compassionate, more wise person. It's not just for your own benefit. Other people will appreciate your compassion and wisdom. It's all come from the crisis in your life. When you put dog poo around your mango tree, you give your dog poo mangoes to everybody. To your friends, to your relations, even to your favourite monk. We get mangoes too. And they all come from the dog poo. That answer your question? Sort of? Okay. Is there any other question? Yes. Certainly, because even in the ancient scriptures, the Buddha actually said there's many, many hundred thousand fold world systems. And just, you know, this planet is not the only world system, you know, in the universe. And he also said there have been many serial universes. It's not the first universe cycle. It's not just the first Big Bang. Yeah, speak for yourself, but... Sorry, I'm a monk. Some beings would have done that and would have evolved from that. Some beings would be in many of the other realms of existence, which sometimes even like ghost realms and like heavenly realms, deva realms, sometimes people think that can't exist because they never experienced it. Fine, but you can experience those realms, and those realms do exist. It may seem strange, why can those realms exist? But like, I had my perceptions actually challenged when I did, you know, quantum physics. And I realized just how little I knew and how much I assumed. That was the best thing which I got from that. Correct. You can get reborn on other planets, other realms of existence. Sometimes, as human beings, sometimes we're very conceited, thinking we know so much. But what we know of this, you know, life is just so small. You know, sometimes, maybe 100 years from now, they look back upon this life and think we're just like people in the Middle Ages who thought the world was flat. People actually believe the world was flat. You go so far, you fall off the edge. It's stupidity. But people believe that because that was their experience at the time. It was obvious for many people. You look at the world and it's flat. But now we know different. Now we know even the universe is curved. Three-dimensional curve. So you can go in any direction. Any direction you want, you come back right here where you started. Long enough. How can that happen? It's just, you know, when you get your head around that, you understand that's actually true. You can understand that, you know, that you can't go faster than the speed of light. But you can still go to, say, a solar system, a star system 10 light years from here in 10 minutes. And that is not a contradiction. Because, you know, your perception of distances changes with speed. That's what the theory of relativity is all about. So that's what looks like a contradiction. How can you get to a star 10 light years from here in 10 minutes and not break the speed of light? Yes, certainly. That's how. Because when you start going faster, you get what's called the Lorentz contraction, which means the distance actually appears less. And time dilates as well. So time is actually different for you. You've heard that thing about two twins. One goes off at the speed of light and comes back, and you know, his twin brother, born on the same day, is now an old man. He's still like a young boy. Because time changes. And that's true. It's been proved to be true. So your perceptions of time, your perceptions of space, now that is challenged. Your experience is not real. Because it's been changed, been conditioned. And this is actually why that sometimes we say rebirth can't happen. Look, you're limiting your experience. You know, it can. Reconciling which two? Oh, yeah. Like evolution is actually too small a time scale. And you've got to look at the bigger picture. Not just one sort of planet evolving, but, you know, whole solar systems, whole galaxies, even bigger than a galaxy. You know, whole universes sort of evolving. And whole evolutions of universal cycles. You know, we started off, you know, people thought that Now, my village was the be-all and end-all of the world. And then we travelled and found out there were other villages. And so we thought my country was a middle country. And it was the only place where people lived. And then we explored further in ships and found out there were other countries, other races, other people. And then we start realizing this Earth is not just the centre of the universe. We found out that it's got a whole solar system. And we found our solar system is not the centre of the universe, but it's just on the edge of a spiral galaxy. And even our galaxy is not the centre of the universe. And even our universe is not the centre of things, but many, many others. We always think we're the centre of things. And that's our sort of delusion. It's our pride. We think that this universal cycle is the most important. The Buddha remembered 91 universal cycles. This is from Big Bang to either Big Crunch or just whimper. Sometimes it goes one way, sometimes the other way. This is actually said by the Buddha because of remembering the past lives. Could even remember that far back. And it's fascinating. I always think, why did he say 91? Just because that's what he remembered, that's all. Not 78, not 100, fascinating figure. It was 91. That's all he could remember. Pretty good memory, I say. So it just gives this different conception of time, much more than just the simple evolution of this planet, but many other planets where human beings could have been, similar beings could have been born. Not the same, not with the same ears or whatever, but similar life forms, similar consciousnesses, exploring the world. Fascinating concept. And that's, I'm not making that up, that's traditional Buddhism from the old suttas. Fascinating idea, really bending the mind. Which is what we're supposed to do. To bend the mind, to actually open up to experiences which at first seem impossible. They seem to be contradictory. But when we actually open up, we find, yeah, it's true. So be careful. What you believe is true is not the whole story. Okay. So any other questions before we finish off? Are you? Yeah, go on. Yeah, fear usually comes from ill will and hatred of the situation. It's also that fear comes when we're about to lose something. But I think most of the case is actually the delusion of thinking someone is different than us. That's where we get into a lot of difficulty. If a feminist thinks that men are different than they are, they're not different. Just in a different body, that's all. So there's a lot of times we get into what's called tribalism. That my race is better than your race, or my village is better than the village next door. And this is actually the tribalism of our world is what causes so much problem. And if we're American and they're Iraqis, they're not just human beings, that's all. We're just people, we're just beings. Now we've got speciesism where we think, okay, human beings, we're all the same, but we're much better than the animals. So we can eat them. We can torture them. We can use them in experiments. We can maltreat them. And this is one of the problems here. And that's actually the delusion. If we actually only see more deeply, we find that every being has the same sort of mind as you have. Underneath the body, beneath the form of our life, there's something which we have in common with all living beings, which when it's seen, will only bring compassion for all living beings. When we see what's in common, in the same way we have compassion for each other. What do you mean by each other? You mean people similar to me? Or rather, beings similar to me. And we actually see that. We go beyond fear, beyond desire, what I want. And we go to truth, and we find there's so much in common with others. And if the Americans or the British actually could see what they had in common with the other Iraqi soldiers, or if the Protestants could see what they have in common with the Catholics in Northern Ireland, or whatever, the Israelis with the Arabs, see what they have in common, then there can't be any wars anymore. How can you fight your friends? I think it's that the delusion causes the fear. Okay, I think that's a lot, because I'm getting afraid that many people are leaving and we haven't made the announcements yet, and I get in trouble from our president. And so out of fear in upsetting our president, I am now going to ask him to give the advert.